the less it is shaped by genes and the more by environment. Stages. What stages of child development help explain the good, bad, in-between adult behavior that got the ball rolling in Chapter 1? The mother of all developmental stage theories was supplied in 1923, pioneered by Jean Piaget's clever, elegant experiments revealing four stages of cognitive development. Sensory motor stage, birth to around 24 months. Thought concerns only what the child can directly sense and explore. During this stage, typically at around 8 months, children develop object permanence, understanding that even if they can't see an object, it still exists. The infant can generate a mental image of something no longer there. Pre-operational stage, around 2 to 7 years. The child can maintain ideas about how the world works without explicit examples in front of him. Thoughts are increasingly symbolic. Imaginary play abounds. However, reasoning is intuitive. No logic, no cause and effect. This is when kids can't yet demonstrate conservation of volume. Identical beakers A and B are filled with equal amounts of water. Pour the contents of beaker B into beaker C, which is taller and thinner. Ask the child, which has more water, A or C? Kids in the pre-operational stage use incorrect folk intuition. The water line in C is higher than that in A. It must contain more water. Concrete operational stage, 7 to 12 years. Kids think logically, no longer falling for that different-shaped beakers nonsense. However, generalizing logic from specific cases is iffy, as is abstract thinking. For example, proverbs are interpreted literally. Birds of a feather flock together means that similar birds form flocks. Formal operational stage, adolescence onward. Approaching adult levels of abstraction, reasoning, and metacognition. Other aspects of cognitive development are also conceptualized in stages. An early stage occurs when toddlers form ego boundaries. There is a me separate from everyone else. A lack of ego boundaries is shown when a toddler isn't all that solid on where he ends and mommy starts. She's cut her finger, and he claims his finger hurts. Next comes the stage of realizing that other individuals have different information than you do. 9-month-olds look where someone points, as can other apes and dogs, knowing the pointer has information that they don't. This is fueled by motivation. Where is that toy? Where's she looking? Older kids understand more broadly that other people have different thoughts, beliefs, and knowledge than they. The landmark of achieving theory of mind, TOM. Here's what not having TOM looks like. A 2-year-old and an adult see a cookie placed in box A. The adult leaves, and the researcher switches the cookie to box B. Ask the child, when that person comes back, where will he look for the cookie? Box B. The child knows it's there, and thus everyone knows. Around age 3 or 4, the child can reason, they'll think it's an A, even though I know it's in B. Shazam. T-O-M. Mastering such false belief tests is a major developmental landmark. T-O-M then progresses to fancier insightfulness, e.g. grasping irony, perspective taking, or secondary T-O-M. Understanding person A's TOM about person B. Various cortical regions mediate TOM. Parts of the medial PFC, surprise, and some new players, including the precuneus, the superior temporal sulcus, and the temporoparietal junction, TPJ. This is shown with neuroimaging by TOM deficits if these regions are damaged. Autistic individuals who have limited TOM have decreased gray matter and activity in the superior temporal sulcus, and by the fact that if you temporarily inactivate the TPJ, people don't consider someone's intentions when judging them morally. Thus, there are stages of gaze following, followed by primary TOM, then secondary TOM, then perspective taking, with the speed of transitions influenced by experience, e.g. kids with older siblings, achieve TOM earlier than average. Naturally, there are criticisms of stage approaches to cognitive development. One is at the heart of this book. A Piagetian framework sits in a cognition bucket, ignoring the impact of social and emotional factors. One example to be discussed in Chapter 12 concerns pre-verbal infants who sure don't grasp transitivity. If A is greater than B and B is greater than C, then A is greater than C. Show a violation of transitivity in interactions between shapes on a screen, shape A should knock over shape C, but the opposite occurs, and the kid is unbothered, doesn't look for long. But personify the shapes with eyes and a mouth, and now heart rate increases. The kid looks longer. Whoa! Character C is supposed to move out of character A's way, not the reverse. Humans understand logical operations between individuals earlier than between objects. Social and motivational state can shift cognitive stage as well. Rudiments of TOM are more demonstrable in chimps who are interacting with another chimp versus a human, and if there is something motivating, food, involved. Emotion and affect can alter cognitive stage in remarkably local ways. I saw a wonderful example of this when my daughter displayed both TOM and failure of TOM in the same breath. She had changed preschools and was visiting her old class. She told everyone about life in her new school. Then, after lunch, we play on the swings. There are swings at my new school. And then after that, we go inside and Carol Lee reads us a story. Then after that, TOM, play on the swings. Wait, they don't know that my school has swings. I need to tell them. Failure of TOM, Carol Lee reads us a story. Carol Lee, the teacher at her new school, the same logic should apply. Tell them who Carol Lee is. But because Carol Lee was the most wonderful teacher alive, TOM failed. Afterward, I asked her, hey, why didn't you tell everyone that Carol Lee is your teacher? Oh, everyone knows Carol Lee. How could everyone not? Feeling someone else's pain. TOM leads to a next step. People can have different feelings than me, including pained ones. This realization is not sufficient for empathy. After all, sociopaths, who pathologically lack empathy, use superb TOM to stay 3 manipulative, remorseless steps ahead of everyone. Nor is this realization strictly necessary for empathy, as kids too young for TOM show rudiments of feeling someone else's pain. A toddler will try to comfort someone feigning crying, offering them her pacifier. And the empathy is rudimentary in that the toddler can't imagine someone being comforted by different things than she is. Yes, very rudimentary. Maybe the toddler feels profound empathy. Or maybe she's just distressed by the crying and is self-interestedly trying to quiet the adult. The childhood capacity for empathy progresses from feeling someone's pain because you are them to feeling for the other person, to feeling as them. The neurobiology of kid empathy makes sense. As introduced in Chapter 2, in adults, the anterior cingulate cortex activates when they see someone hurt. Ditto for the amygdala and insula, especially in instances of intentional harm. There is anger and disgust. VFC regions, including the emotional VMPFC, are on board. Observing physical pain, e.g. a finger being poked with a needle, produces a concrete vicarious pattern. There is activation of the para-aqueductal gray, PAG, a region central to your own pain perception. In parts of the sensory cortex receiving sensation from your own fingers, and in motor neurons that command your own fingers to move. You clench your fingers. Work by Jean DeSetti of the University of Chicago shows that when 7-year-olds watch someone in pain, activation is greatest in the more concrete regions, the PAG, and the sensory and motor cortices, with PAG activity coupled to the minimal VMPFC activation there is. In older kids, the VMPFC is coupled to increasingly activated limbic structures. And by adolescents, the stronger VMPFC activation is coupled to TOM regions. What's happening? Empathy is shifting from the concrete world of her finger must hurt, I'm suddenly conscious of my own finger, to TOM-ish focusing on the pokey's emotions and experience. Young kids' empathy doesn't distinguish between intentional and unintentional harm or between harm to a person and to an object. Those distinctions emerge with age, around the time when the PAG part of empathic responses lessens, and there is more engagement of the VMPFC and TOM regions. Moreover, intentional harm now activates the amygdala and insula, anger and disgust at the perpetrator. This is also when kids first distinguish between self and other inflicted pain. More sophistication. By around age 7, kids are expressing their empathy. By ages 10 through 12, empathy is more generalized and abstracted. Empathy for poor people rather than one individual. Downside, this is also when kids first negatively stereotype categories of people. There are also hints of a sense of justice. Preschoolers tend to be egalitarians, e.g., it's better that the friend gets a cookie when she does. But before we get carried away with the generosity of youth, there is already in-group bias. If the other child is a stranger, there is less egalitarianism. There is also a growing tendency of kids to respond to an injustice when someone has been treated unfairly. But once again, before getting carried away with things, it comes with a bias. By ages 4 through 6, kids in cultures from around the world respond negatively when they are the ones being shortchanged. It isn't until ages 8 through 10 that kids respond negatively to someone else being treated unfairly. Moreover, there is considerable cross-cultural variability as to whether that later stage even emerges. The sense of justice in young kids is a very self-interested one. Soon after kids start responding negatively to someone else being treated unjustly, they begin attempting to rectify previous inequalities. He should get more now because he got less before. By pre-adolescence, egalitarianism gives way to acceptance of inequality because of merit or effort or for a greater good. She should play more than him. She's better / worked harder / is more important to the team. Some kids even manage self-sacrifice for the greater good. She should play more than me. She's better. By adolescence, boys tend to accept inequality more than girls do on utilitarian grounds, and both sexes are acquiescing to inequality as social convention. Nothing can be done. That's the way it is. Moral development. With TOM, perspective taking, nuanced empathy, and a sense of justice in place, a child can start wrestling with telling right from wrong. Piaget emphasized how much kids' play is about working out rules of appropriate behavior, rules that can differ from those of adults, and how this involves stages of increasing complexity. This inspired a younger psychologist to investigate the topic more rigorously, with enormously influential consequences. In the 1950s, Lawrence Kohlberg, then a graduate student at the University of Chicago and later a professor at Harvard, began formulating his monumental stages of moral development. Kids would be presented with moral conundrums. For example, the only dose of the only drug that will save a poor woman from dying is prohibitively expensive. Should she steal it? Why? Kohlberg concluded that moral judgment is a cognitive process, built around increasingly complex reasoning as kids mature. He proposed his famed 3 stages of moral development, each with 2 subparts. You've been told not to eat the tempting cookie in front of you. Should you eat it? Here are the painfully simplified stages of reasoning that go into the decision. Level 1. Should I eat the cookie? Pre-conventional reasoning. Stage 1. It depends. How likely am I to get punished? Being punished is unpleasant. Aggression typically peaks around ages 2 through 4, after which kids are reined in by adults' punishment, go sit in the corner, and peers, i.e. being ostracized. Stage 2. It depends. If I refrain, will I get rewarded? Being rewarded is nice. Both stages are ego-oriented, obedience and self-interest. What's in it for me? Kohlberg found that children are typically at this level up to around ages 8 through 10. Concern arises when aggression, particularly if callous and remorseless, doesn't wane around these ages. This predicts an increased risk of adult sociopathy, aka antisocial personality. Crucially, the behavior of future sociopaths seems impervious to negative feedback. As noted, high pain thresholds in sociopaths help explain their lack of empathy. It's hard to feel someone else's pain when you can't feel your own. It also helps explain the imperviousness to negative feedback. Why change your behavior if punishment doesn't register? It is also around this stage that kids first reconcile after conflicts and derive comfort from reconciliation, e.g., decreasing glucocorticoid secretion and anxiety. Those benefits certainly suggest self-interest motivating reconciliation. This is shown in another realpolitik way. Kids reconcile more readily when the relationship matters to them. Level 2. Should I eat the cookie? Conventional reasoning. Stage 3. It depends. Who will be deprived if I do? Do I like them? What would other people do? What will people think of me for eating the cookie? It's nice to think of others. It's good to be well regarded. Stage 4. It depends. What's the law? Are laws sacrosanct? What if everyone broke this law? It's nice to have order. This is the judge who, considering predatory but legal lending practices by a bank, thinks, I feel sorry for these victims, but I'm here to decide whether the bank broke a law, and it didn't. Conventional moral reasoning is relational, about your interactions with others and their consequences. Most adolescents and adults are at this level. Level 3. Should I eat the cookie? Post-conventional reasoning. Stage 5. It depends. What circumstances placed the cookie there? Who decided that I shouldn't take it? Would I save a life by taking the cookie? It's nice when clear rules are applied flexibly. Now the judge would think, yes, the bank's actions were legal, but ultimately laws exist to protect the weak from the mighty, so signed contract or otherwise, that bank must be stopped. Stage 6. It depends. Is my moral stance regarding this more vital than some law, a stance for which I'd pay the ultimate price if need be? It's nice to know there are things for which I'd repeatedly sing, we will not be moved. This level is egoistic in that rules and their application come from within and reflect conscience, where a transgression exacts the ultimate cost, having to live with yourself afterward. It recognizes that being good and being law-abiding aren't synonymous. As Woody Guthrie wrote in Pretty Boy Floyd, I love a good man outside the law just as much as I hate a bad man inside the law. Stage 6 is also egotistical, implicitly built on self-righteousness, that trumps conventional petty bourgeois rulemakers and bean counters, the man, those sheep who just follow, etc. To quote Emerson, as is often done when considering the post-conventional stage, every heroic act measures itself by its contempt of some external good. Stage 6 reasoning can inspire, but it can also be insufferable, premised on being good and being law-abiding as opposites. To live outside the law, you must be honest, wrote Bob Dylan. Kohlbergians found hardly anyone consistently at stage 5 or stage 6. Kohlberg basically invented the scientific study of moral development in children. His stage model is so canonical that people in the business diss someone by suggesting they're stuck in the primordial soup of a primitive Kohlberg stage. As we'll see in Chapter 12, there is even evidence that conservatives and liberals reason at different Kohlberg stages. Naturally, Kohlberg's work has problems. The usual. Don't take any stage model too seriously. There are exceptions, maturational transitions are not clean-cut, and someone's stage can be context-dependent. The problem of tunnel vision and wrong emphases. Kohlberg initially studied the usual unrepresentative humans, namely Americans, and as we will see in later chapters, moral judgments differ cross-culturally. Moreover, subjects were male, something challenged in the 1980s by Carol Gilligan of NYU. The two agreed on the general sequence of stages. However, Gilligan and others showed that in making moral judgments, girls and women generally value care over justice, in contrast to boys and men. As a result, females tilt toward conventional thinking and its emphasis on relationships, while males tilt toward post-conventional abstractions. The cognitive emphasis. Are moral judgments more the outcome of reasoning or of intuition and emotion? Kohlbergians favor the former. But as will be seen in Chapter 13, plenty of organisms with limited cognitive skills, including young kids and non-human primates, display rudimentary senses of fairness and justice. Such findings anchor social intuitionist views of moral decision-making associated with psychologists Martin Hoffman and Jonathan Haidt, both of NYU. Naturally, the question becomes how moral reasoning and moral intuitionism interact. As we'll see, A, rather than being solely about emotion, moral intuition is a different style of cognition from conscious reasoning. And B, conversely, moral reasoning is often flagrantly illogical. Stay tuned. The lack of predictability. Does any of this actually predict who does the harder thing when it's the right thing to do? Are gold medalists at Kohlbergian reasoning the ones willing to pay the price for whistleblowing, subduing the shooter, sheltering refugees? Heck, forget the heroics. Are they even more likely to be honest in dinky psych experiments? In other words, does moral reasoning predict moral action? Rarely, as we will see in Chapter 13, moral heroism rarely arises from super-duper frontal cortical willpower. Instead, it happens when the right thing isn't the harder thing. Marshmallows. The frontal cortex and its increasing connectivity with the rest of the brain anchors the neurobiology of kids' growing sophistication, most importantly in their capacity to regulate emotions and behavior. The most iconic demonstration of this revolves around an unlikely object, the marshmallow. In the 1960s, Stanford psychologist Walter Mischel developed the marshmallow test to study gratification postponement. A child is presented with a marshmallow. The experimenter says, "I'm going out of the room for a while. You can eat the marshmallow after I leave. But if you wait and don't eat it until I get back, I'll give you another marshmallow." And leaves. And the child, observed through a two-way mirror, begins the lonely challenge of holding out for 15 minutes until the researcher returns. Studying hundreds of 3 to 6-year-olds, Mischel saw enormous variability. A few ate the marshmallow before the experimenter left the room. About a third lasted the 15 minutes. The rest were scattered in between, averaging a delay of 11 minutes. Kids' strategies for resisting the marshmallow's siren call differed, as can be seen on contemporary versions of the test on YouTube. Some kids cover their eyes, hide the marshmallow, sing to distract themselves. Others grimace, sit on their hands. Others sniff the marshmallow, pinch off an infinitely tiny piece to eat, hold it reverentially, kiss it, pet it. Various factors modulated kids' fortitude, shown in later studies described in Michelle's book, where, for some reason, it was pretzels instead of marshmallows. Trusting the system mattered. If experimenters had previously betrayed on promises, kids wouldn't wait as long. Prompting kids to think about how crunchy and yummy pretzels are, what Michelle calls hot ideation, nuked self-discipline. Prompts to think about a cold ideation, e.g. the shape of pretzels, or an alternative hot ideation, e.g. ice cream, bolstered resistance. As expected, older kids hold out longer, using more effective strategies. Younger kids describe strategies like, "I kept thinking about how good that second marshmallow would taste." The problem, of course, is that this strategy is about two synapses away from thinking about the marshmallow in front of you. In contrast, older kids use strategies of distraction, thinking about toys, pets, their birthday. This progresses to reappraisal strategies. "This isn't about marshmallows. This is about the kind of person I am." To Michelle, maturation of willpower is more about distraction and reappraisal strategies than about stoicism. So kids improve at delayed gratification. Michelle's next step made his studies iconic. He tracked the kids afterward, seeing if marshmallow wait time predicted anything about their adulthoods. Did it ever? 5-year-old champs at marshmallow patients averaged higher SAT scores in high school, compared with those who couldn't wait, with more social success and resilience and less aggressive and oppositional behavior. Footnote. A recent study adds an important twist to this story. There are the kids with problems with impulse control, I'm absolutely going to hold out for 2 marshmallow, who then instantly eat that first one. That profile is a statistical predictor of adult violent crime. In contrast, there are kids with steep time discounting curves. Wait 15 minutes for 2 marshmallows when I can have 1 right now? What kind of fool waits 15 minutes? That is a predictor of adult property crime. 40 years post-marshmallow, they excelled at frontal function, had more PFC activation during a frontal task, and had lower BMIs. A gazillion-dollar brain scanner doesn't hold more predictive power than 1 marshmallow. Every anxious middle-class parent obsesses over these findings, has made marshmallows fetish items. Consequences. We've now gotten a sense of various domains of behavioral development. Time to frame things with this book's central question. Our adult has carried out that wonderful or crummy or ambiguous behavior. What childhood events contributed to that occurring? A first challenge is to truly incorporate biology into our thinking. A child suffers malnutrition and, as an adult, has poor cognitive skills. That's easy to frame biologically. Malnutrition impairs brain development. Alternatively, a child is raised by cold, inexpressive parents and, as an adult, feels unlovable. It's harder to link those two biologically, to resist thinking that somehow this is a less biological phenomenon than the malnutrition/cognition link. There may be less known about the biological changes explaining the link between cold parents and the adult with poor self-esteem than about the malnutrition/cognition one. It may be less convenient to articulate the former biologically than the latter. It may be harder to apply a proximal biological therapy for the former than for the latter, e.g. an imaginary neural growth factor drug that improves self-esteem versus cognition. But biology mediates both links. A cloud may be less tangible than a brick, but it's constructed with the same rules about how atoms interact. How does biology link childhood with the behaviors of adulthood? Chapter 5's Neural Plasticity, writ Large and Early. The developing brain epitomizes neural plasticity, and every hiccup of experience has an effect, albeit usually a minuscule one, on that brain. We now examine ways in which different types of childhoods produce different sorts of adults. Let's start at the very beginning, the importance of mothers. Nothing like a section heading stating the obvious. Everybody needs a mother. Even rodents. Separate rat pups from mom a few hours daily, and as adults, they have elevated glucocorticoid levels and poor cognitive skills, are anxious, and if male, are more aggressive. Mothers are crucial. Except that well into the 20th century, most experts didn't think so. The West developed child-rearing techniques where, when compared with traditional cultures, children had less physical contact with their mothers, slept alone at earlier ages, and had longer latencies to be picked up when crying. Around 1900, the leading expert Luther Holt of Columbia University warned against the vicious practice of picking up a crying child or handling her too often. This was the world of children of the wealthy, raised by nannies and presented to their parents before bedtime to be briefly seen but not heard. This period brought one of history's strangest one-night stands, namely when the Freudians and the behaviorists hooked up to explain why infants become attached to their mothers. To behaviorists, obviously, it's because mothers reinforce them. providing calories when they're hungry. For Freudians, also obviously, infants lack the ego development to form a relationship with anything/anyone other than mom's breasts. When combined with children should be seen but not heardism, this suggested that once you've addressed a child's need for nutrition, proper temperature, plus other odds and ends, they're set to go. Affection, warmth, physical contact, superfluous. Such thinking produced at least one disaster. When a child was hospitalized for a stretch, dogma was that the mother was unnecessary. She just added emotional tumult, and everything essential was supplied by the staff. Typically, mothers could visit their children once a week for a few minutes. And when kids were hospitalized for extended periods, they wasted away with hospitalism, dying in droves from nonspecific infections and gastrointestinal maladies unrelated to their original illness. This was an era when the germ theory had mutated into the belief that hospitalized children do best when untouched, in antiseptic isolation. Remarkably, hospitalism soared in hospitals with newfangled incubators adapted from poultry farming. The safest hospitals were poor ones that relied on the primitive act of humans actually touching and interacting with infants. In the 1950s, the British psychiatrist John Bowlby challenged the view of infants as simple organisms with few emotional needs. His attachment theory birthed our modern view of the mother-infant bond. In his trilogy, Attachment and Loss, Bowlby summarized the no-brainer answers we'd give today to the question, what do children need from their mothers? Love, warmth, affection, responsiveness, stimulation, consistency, reliability. What is produced in their absence? Anxious, depressed, and/or poorly attached adults. Footnote. Naturally, by now, Bowlby's offspring, the school of attachment parenting, is so established as to have generated endless misconceptions, fads, cults, lunatic fringes, and crazy-making senses of neurotic inadequacy or self-righteous superiority among parents. To open a can of worms a smidgen, there is no scientific support for concluding that a woman has irreparably damaged her child if she does not breastfeed, breastfeeds for less than the first decade of the child's life, can't successfully breastfeed her child within seconds after birth, or ever leaves the child alone for more than 2 seconds, let alone works outside of the house. And nothing about the science says that the same good effects of attachment can't be provided by a man, a working single mother, two mommies, or two daddies. Bowlby inspired one of the most iconic experiments in psychology's history by Harry Harlow of the University of Wisconsin. It destroyed Freudian and behaviorist dogma about mother-infant bonding. Harlow would raise an infant rhesus monkey without a mother, but with two surrogates instead. Both were made of a chicken wire tube approximating a torso, with a monkey-ish plastic head on top. One surrogate had a bottle of milk coming from its torso. The other had terry cloth wrapped around the torso. In other words, one gave calories, the other a poignant approximation of a mother monkey's fur. Freud and B.F. Skinner would have wrestled over access to chicken wire mom. But infant monkeys chose the terry cloth mom. Man cannot live by milk alone. Love is an emotion that does not need to be bottle or spoon-fed, wrote Harlow. Evidence for the most basic need provided by a mother comes from a controversial quarter. Starting in the 1990s, crime rates plummeted across the United States. Why? For liberals, the answer was the thriving economy. For conservatives, it was the larger budgets for policing, expanded prisons, and 3-strike sentencing laws. Meanwhile, a partial explanation was provided by legal scholar John Donahue of Stanford and economist Stephen Levitt of the University of Chicago. It was the legalization of abortions. The author's state-by-state analysis of the liberalization of abortion laws and the demographics of the crime drop showed that when abortions became readily available in an area, rates of crime by young adults decline about 20 years later. Surprise, this was highly controversial, but it makes perfect, depressing sense to me. What majorly predicts a life of crime? Being born to a mother who, if she could, would have chosen that you not be. What's the most basic thing provided by a mother? Knowing that she is happy that you exist. Harlow also helped demonstrate a cornerstone of this book, namely what mothers, and later peers, provide as children grow. To do so, he performed some of the most inflammatory research in psychology's history. This involved raising infant monkeys in isolation, absent mother or peers. They spent the first months, even years of their lives, without contact with another living being before being placed in a social group. Predictably, they'd be wrecks. Some would sit alone, clutching themselves, rocking autistically. Others would be markedly inappropriate in their hierarchical or sexual behaviors. There was something interesting. It wasn't that these ex-isolates did behaviors wrong. They didn't aggressively display, like an ostrich, make the sexually solicitive gestures of a gecko. Behaviors were normal, but occurred at the wrong time and place. Say, giving subordination gestures to pipsqueaks half their size, threatening alphas they should cower before. Mothers and peers don't teach the motoric features of fixed action patterns. Those are hardwired. They teach when, where, and to whom the appropriate context for those behaviors. They give the first lessons about when touching someone's arm or pulling a trigger can be among the best or worst of our behaviors. I saw a striking example of this among the baboons that I study in Kenya when both a high-ranking and a low-ranking female gave birth to daughters the same week. The former's kid hit every developmental landmark earlier than the other, the playing field already unlevel. When the infants were a few weeks old, they nearly had their first interaction. Daughter of subordinate mom spotted daughter of dominant one, toddled over to say hello. And as she got near, her low-ranking mother grabbed her by the tail and pulled her back. This was her first lesson about her place in that world. You see her? She's much higher ranking than you, so you don't just go and hang with her. If she's around, you sit still and avoid eye contact and hope she doesn't take whatever you're eating. Amazingly, in 20 years, those two infants would be old ladies, sitting in the savanna, still displaying the rank asymmetries they learned that morning. Any kind of mother in a storm. Harlow provided another important lesson thanks to another study painful to contemplate. Infant monkeys were raised with chicken wire surrogates with air jets in the middle of their torsos. When an infant clung, she'd receive an aversive blast of air. What would a behaviorist predict that the monkey would do when faced with such punishment? Flee. But as in the world of abused children and battered partners, infants held harder. Why do we often become attached to a source of negative reinforcement? Seek solace when distressed from the cause of that distress. Why do we ever love the wrong person, get abused, and return for more? Psychological insights abound because of poor self-esteem, believing you'll never do better, or a codependent conviction that it's your calling to change the person. Maybe you identify with your oppressor, or have decided it's your fault and the abuser is justified, so they seem less irrational and terrifying. These are valid and can have huge explanatory and therapeutic power, but work by Regina Sullivan of NYU demonstrates bits of this phenomenon miles from the human psyche. Sullivan would condition rat pups to associate a neutral odor with a shock. If a pup that had been conditioned at 10 days of age or older, older pups, was exposed to that odor, logical things happened. Amygdala activation, glucocorticoid secretion, and avoidance of the odor. But do the same to a younger pup, and none of that would occur. Remarkably, the pup would be attracted to the odor. Why? There is an interesting wrinkle related to stress in newborns. Rodent fetuses are perfectly capable of secreting glucocorticoids, but within hours of birth, the adrenal glands atrophy dramatically, becoming barely able to secrete glucocorticoids. This stress hyporesponsive period, SHRP, wanes over the coming weeks. What is the SHRP about? Glucocorticoids have so many adverse effects on brain development, stay tuned, that the SHRP represents a gamble. I won't secrete glucocorticoids in response to stress so that I develop optimally. If something stressful happens, Mom will handle it for me. Accordingly, deprive infant rats of their mothers, and within hours, their adrenals expand and regain the ability to secrete plenty of glucocorticoids. During the SHRP, infants seem to use a further rule. If Mom is around, and I thus don't secrete glucocorticoids, I should get attached to any strong stimulus. It couldn't be bad for me. Mom wouldn't allow that. As evidence, inject glucocorticoids into the amygdala of young pups during the conditioning, and the amygdala would activate, and the pups would develop an aversion to the odor. Conversely, block glucocorticoid secretion in older pups during conditioning, and they'd become attracted to the odor. Or condition them with their mother present, and they wouldn't secrete glucocorticoids and would develop an attraction. In other words, in young rats, even aversive things are reinforcing in Mom's presence, even if Mom is the source of the aversive stimuli. As Sullivan and colleagues wrote, attachment by such an infant to the caretaker has evolved to ensure that the infant forms a bond to that caregiver regardless of the quality of care received. Any kind of mother in a storm. If this applies to humans, it helps explain why individuals abused as kids are, as adults, prone toward relationships in which they are abused by their partner. But what about the flip side? Why is it that about 33% of adults who were abused as children become abusers themselves? Again, useful psychological insights abound, built around identification with the abuser and rationalizing away the terror. I love my kids, but I smack them around when they need it. My father did that to me, so he could have loved me too. But once again, something biologically deeper also occurs. Infant monkeys abused by their mothers are more likely to become abusive mothers. Different routes to the same place. I anticipated that, with mothers now covered, we'd next examine the adult consequences of, say, paternal deprivation, or childhood poverty, or exposure to violence or natural disasters. And there'd be the same question. What specific biological changes did each cause in children that increased the odds of specific adult behaviors? But this plan didn't work. The similarities of effects of these varied traumas are greater than the differences. Sure, there are specific links, e.g., childhood exposure to domestic violence makes adult antisocial violence more likely than does childhood exposure to hurricanes. But they all converge sufficiently that I will group them together, as is done in the field, as examples of childhood adversity. Basically, childhood adversity increases the odds of an adult having A, depression, anxiety, and/or substance abuse, B, impaired cognitive capabilities, particularly related to frontocortical function, C, impaired impulse control and emotion regulation, D, antisocial behavior, including violence, and E, relationships that replicate the adversities of childhood, e.g. staying with an abusive partner. And despite that, some individuals endure miserable childhoods just fine. More on this to come. We'll now examine the biological links between childhood adversity and increased risk of these adult outcomes. The biological profile. All these forms of adversity are obviously stressful and cause abnormalities in stress physiology. Across numerous species, major early life stressors produce both kids and adults with elevated levels of glucocorticoids, along with CRH and ACTH, the hypothalamic and pituitary hormones that regulate glucocorticoid release, and hyperactivity of the sympathetic nervous system. Basal glucocorticoid levels are elevated. The stress response is always somewhat activated, and there is delayed recovery back to baseline after a stressor. Michael Meany of McGill University has shown how early life stress permanently blunts the ability of the brain to rein in glucocorticoid secretion. As covered in Chapter 4, marinating the brain in excess glucocorticoids, particularly during development, adversely affects cognition, impulse control, empathy, and so on. There is impaired hippocampal-dependent learning in adulthood. For example, abused children who develop PTSD have decreased volume of the hippocampus in adulthood. Stanford psychiatrist Victor Carrion has shown decreased hippocampal growth within months of the abuse. As a likely cause, glucocorticoids decrease hippocampal production of the growth factor BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So childhood adversity impairs learning and memory. Crucially, it also impairs maturation and function of the frontal cortex. Again, glucocorticoids via inhibiting BDNF are likely culprits. The connection between childhood adversity and frontocortical maturation pertains to childhood poverty. Work by Martha Farah of the University of Pennsylvania, Tom Boyce of UCSF, and others demonstrates something outrageous. By age 5, the lower a child's socioeconomic status, on the average, the A, higher the basal glucocorticoid levels, and or the more reactive the glucocorticoid stress response, B, the thinner the frontal cortex and the lower its metabolism, and C, the poorer the frontal function concerning working memory, emotion regulation, impulse control, and executive decision-making. Moreover, to achieve equivalent frontal regulation, lower SES kids must activate more frontal cortex than do higher SES kids. In addition, childhood poverty impairs maturation of the corpus callosum, a bundle of axonal fibers connecting the two hemispheres and integrating their function. This is so wrong. Foolishly pick a poor family to be born into, and by kindergarten, the odds of your succeeding at life's marshmallow tests are already stacked against you. Considerable research focuses on how poverty gets under the skin. Some mechanisms are human-specific. If you're poor, you're more likely to grow up near environmental toxins, in a dangerous neighborhood with more liquor stores than markets selling produce. You're less likely to attend a good school or have parents with time to read to you. Your community is likely to have poor social capital, and you, poor self-esteem. But part of the link reflects the corrosive effects of subordination in all hierarchical species. For example, having a low-ranking mother predicts elevated glucocorticoids in adulthood in baboons. Thus, childhood adversity can atrophy and blunt the functioning of the hippocampus and frontal cortex, but it's the opposite in the amygdala. Loss of adversity and the amygdala becomes larger and hyperreactive. One consequence is increased risk of anxiety disorders. When coupled with the poor frontocortical development, it explains problems with emotion and behavior regulation, especially impulse control. Childhood adversity accelerates amygdaloid maturation in a particular way. Normally, around adolescence, the frontal cortex gains the ability to inhibit the amygdala, saying, "I wouldn't do this if I were you." But after childhood adversity, the amygdala develops the ability to inhibit the frontal cortex, saying, "I'm doing this, and just try to stop me." Childhood adversity also damages the dopamine system, with its role in reward, anticipation, and goal-directed behavior, in two ways. First, early adversity produces an adult organism more vulnerable to drug and alcohol addiction. The pathway to this vulnerability is probably threefold. A, effects on the developing dopamine system. B, the excessive adult exposure to glucocorticoids, which increases drug craving. C, that poorly developed frontal cortex. Childhood adversity also substantially increases the risk of adult depression. Depression's defining symptom is anhedonia, the inability to feel, anticipate, or pursue pleasure. Chronic stress depletes the mesolimbic system of dopamine, generating anhedonia. The link between childhood adversity and adult depression involves both organizational effects on the developing mesolimbic system and elevated adult glucocorticoid levels, which can deplete dopamine. Childhood adversity increases depression risk via second-hit scenarios, lowering thresholds so that adult stressors that people typically manage instead trigger depressive episodes. This vulnerability makes sense. Depression is fundamentally a pathological sense of loss of control, explaining the classic description of depression as learned helplessness. If a child experiences severe, uncontrollable adversity, the most fortunate conclusion in adulthood is, those were terrible circumstances over which I had no control. But when childhood traumas produce depression, there is cognitively distorted overgeneralization, and life will always be uncontrollably awful. Two side topics. So varied types of childhood adversity converge in producing similar adult problems. Nonetheless, two types of adversity should be considered separately. Observing violence. What happens when children observe domestic violence, warfare, a gang murder, a school massacre? For weeks afterward, there is impaired concentration and impulse control. Witnessing gun violence doubles a child's likelihood of serious violence within the succeeding 2 years. And adulthood brings the usual increased risks of depression, anxiety, and aggression. Consistent with that, violent criminals are more likely than nonviolent ones to have witnessed violence as kids. Footnote. Remarkably, exposure to multiple incidents of violence even accelerates the aging of children's chromosomes. This fits our general picture of childhood adversity. A separate topic is the effects of media violence on kids. Endless studies have analyzed the effects of kids witnessing violence on TV, in movies, in the news, and in music videos, and both witnessing and participating in violent video games. A summary. Exposing children to a violent TV or film clip increases their odds of aggression soon after. Interestingly, the effect is stronger in girls amid their having lower overall levels of aggression. Effects are stronger when kids are younger or when the violence is more realistic and/or is presented as heroic. Such exposure can make kids more accepting of aggression. In one study, watching violent music videos increased adolescent girls' acceptance of dating violence. The violence is key. Aggression isn't boosted by material that's merely exciting, arousing, or frustrating. Heavy childhood exposure to media violence predicts higher levels of aggression in young adults of both sexes, aggression ranging from behavior in an experimental setting to violent criminality. The effect typically remains after controlling for total media watching time, maltreatment or neglect, socioeconomic status, levels of neighborhood violence, parental education, psychiatric illness, and IQ. This is a reliable finding of large magnitude. The link between exposure to childhood media violence and increased adult aggression is stronger than the link between lead exposure and IQ, calcium intake and bone mass, or asbestos and laryngeal cancer. Two caveats. A. There is no evidence that catastrophically violent individuals, e.g. mass shooters, are that way because of childhood exposure to violent media. B. Exposure does not remotely guarantee increased aggression. Instead, effects are strongest on kids already prone toward violence. For them, exposure desensitizes and normalizes their own aggression. Bullying. Being bullied is mostly another garden variety childhood adversity, with adult consequences on par with childhood maltreatment at home. There is a complication, though. As most of us observed, exploited, or experienced as kids, bullying targets aren't selected at random. Kids with the metaphorical "kick me" signs on their backs are more likely to have personal or family psychiatric issues and poor social and emotional intelligence. These are kids already at risk for bad adult outcomes, and adding bullying to the mix just makes the child's future even bleaker. The picture of the bullies is no surprise either, starting with their disproportionately coming from families of single moms or younger parents with poor education and employment prospects. There are generally two profiles of the kids themselves. The more typical is an anxious, isolated kid with poor social skills who bullies out of frustration and to achieve acceptance. Such kids typically mature out of bullying. The second profile is the confident, unempathic, socially intelligent kid with an imperturbable sympathetic nervous system. This is the future sociopath. There is an additional striking finding. You want to see a kid who's really likely to be a mess as an adult? Find someone who both bullies and is bullied, who terrorizes the weaker at school and returns home to be terrorized by someone stronger. Of the three categories, bully, bullied, bully slash bullied, they're most likely to have prior psychiatric problems, poor school performance, and poor emotional adjustment. They're more likely than pure bullies to use weapons and inflict serious damage. As adults, they're most at risk for depression, anxiety, and suicidality. In one study, kids from these three categories read scenarios of bullying. Bullied victims would condemn bullying and express sympathy. Bullies would condemn bullying, but rationalize the scenario, e.g., this time it was the victim's fault. And bully/bullied kids? They would say bullying is okay. No wonder they have the worst outcome. The weak deserve to be bullied, so it's fine when I bully. But that means I deserve to be bullied at home. But I don't, and that relative bullying me is awful. Maybe then I'm awful when I bully someone. But I'm not, because the weak deserve to be bullied. A Mobius strip from hell. A key question. We've now examined adult consequences of childhood adversity and their biological mediators. A key question persists. Yes, childhood abuse increases the odds of being an abusive adult. Witnessing violence raises the risk for PTSD. Loss of a parent to death means more chance of adult depression. Nevertheless, many, maybe even most victims of such adversity, turn into reasonably functional adults. There is a shadow over childhood. Demons lurk in corners of the mind, but overall, things are okay. What explains such resilience? As we'll see, genes and fetal environment are relevant. But most important, recall the logic of collapsing different types of trauma into a single category. What counts is the sheer number of times a child is bludgeoned by life and the number of protective factors. Be sexually abused as a child, or witness violence, and your adult prognosis is better than if you had experienced both. Experience childhood poverty, and your future prospects are better if your family is stable and loving than broken and acrimonious. Pretty straightforwardly, the more categories of adversities a child suffers, the dimmer his or her chances of a happy, functional adulthood. A sledgehammer. What happens when everything goes wrong? No mother or family, minimal peer interactions, sensory and cognitive neglect, plus some malnutrition? These are the Romanian institution kids' poster children for just how nightmarish childhood can be. In the 1980s, the Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu banned contraceptives and abortions and required women to bear at least 5 children. Soon, institutions filled with thousands of infants and kids abandoned by impoverished families, many intent on reclaiming their child when finances improved. Footnote. A shocking part of the story, Roma children were regularly abandoned at orphanages and left there until they were adolescents and could work. Kids were warehoused in overwhelmed institutions, resulting in severe neglect and deprivation. The story broke after Ceausescu's 1989 overthrow. Many kids were adopted by Westerners, and international attention led to some improvements in the institutions. Since then, children adopted in the West, those eventually returned to their families, and those who remained institutionalized have been studied, primarily by Charles Nelson of Harvard. As adults, these kids are mostly what you'd expect: low IQ and poor cognitive skills. Problems with forming attachments, often bordering on autistic. Anxiety and depression galore. The longer the institutionalization, the worse the prognosis. And their brains? Decreased total brain size, gray matter, white matter, frontal cortical metabolism, connectivity between regions, sizes of individual brain regions. Except for the amygdala, which is enlarged. That pretty much says it all. Culture. with both a big and a little c. Chapter 9 considers the effects of culture on our best and worst behaviors. We now preview that chapter, focusing on two facts. Childhood is when culture is inculcated, and parents mediate that process. There is huge cultural variability in how childhood is experienced, how long and often kids are nursed, how often they are in contact with parents and other adults, how often they're spoken to, how long they cry before someone responds, at what age they sleep alone. Considering cross-cultural child-rearing often brings out the most invidious and neurotic in parents, do other cultures do a better job at it? There must be the perfect combo out there, a mixture of the Kwakiutl baby diet, the Trobriand sleeping program, and the Ituri approach to watching baby Mozart videos. But there is no anthropological ideal of child-rearing. Cultures, starting with parents, raise children to become adults who behave in the ways valued by that culture, a point emphasized by the anthropologist Meredith Small of Cornell University. We begin with parenting style, a child's first encounter with cultural values. Interestingly, the most influential typology of parenting style, writ small, grew from thinking about cultural styles, writ large. Amid the post-World War II ruins, scholars tried to understand where Hitler, Franco, Mussolini, Tojo, and their minions came from. What are the roots of fascism? Two particularly influential scholars were refugees from Hitler, namely Hannah Arendt, with her 1951 book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, and Theodore Adorno, with a 1950 book, The Authoritarian Personality, co-authored with Elsa Frankel Brunswick, Daniel Levinson, and Nevitt Sanford. Adorno in particular explored the personality traits of fascists, including extreme conformity, submission to and belief in authority, aggressiveness, and hostility toward intellectualism and introspection, traits typically rooted in childhood. This influenced the Berkeley psychologist Diana Baumrind, who in the 1960s identified three key parenting styles, in work since replicated and extended to various cultures. First is authoritative parenting. Rules and expectations are clear, consistent, and explicable, because I said so is anathema, with room for flexibility. Praise and forgiveness trump punishment. Parents welcome children's input. Developing children's potential and autonomy is paramount. By the standards of the educated neurotics who would read, let alone write, this book, this produces a good adult outcome, happy, emotionally and socially mature and fulfilled, independent, and self-reliant. Next is authoritarian parenting. Rules and demands are numerous, arbitrary, and rigid, and need no justification. Behavior is mostly shaped by punishment. Children's emotional needs are low priorities. Parental motivation is often that it's a tough, unforgiving world, and kids better be prepared. Authoritarian parenting tends to produce adults who may be narrowly successful, obedient, conformist, often with an undercurrent of resentment that can explode, and not particularly happy. Moreover, social skills are often poor because, instead of learning by experience, they grew up following orders. And then there is permissive parenting, the aberration that supposedly let boomers invent the 1960s. There are few demands or expectations. Rules are rarely enforced, and children set the agenda. Adult outcome? Self-indulgent individuals with poor impulse control, low frustration tolerance, plus poor social skills thanks to living consequence-free childhoods. Baumrind's trio was expanded by Stanford psychologists Eleanor Maccabee and John Martin to include neglectful parenting. This addition produces a 2x2 matrix. Parenting is authoritative, high demand, high responsiveness. Authoritarian, high demand, low responsiveness. Permissive, low demand, high responsiveness. Or neglectful, low demand, low responsiveness. Importantly, each style usually produces adults with that same approach, with different cultures valuing different styles. Then comes the next way cultural values are transmitted to kids, namely by peers. This was emphasized in Judith Rich Harris's The Nurture Assumption. Harris, a psychologist without an academic affiliation or doctorate, took the field by storm, arguing that the importance of parenting in shaping a child's adult personality is exaggerated. Instead, once kids pass a surprisingly young age, peers are most influential. Elements of her argument included A. Parental influence is often actually mediated via peers. For example, being raised by a single mother increases the risk of adult antisocial behavior, but not because of the parenting. Instead, because of typically lower income, kids more likely live in a neighborhood with tough peers. B. Peers have impact on linguistic development, e.g., children acquire the accent of their peers, not their parents. C. Other young primates are mostly socialized by peers, not mothers. The book was controversial, partially because the theme begged to be distorted. Psychologist proves that parents don't matter, drawing criticism and acclaim. As the dust has settled, current opinion tends to be that peer influences are underappreciated, but parents still are plenty important, including by influencing what peer groups their kids experience. Why are peers so